Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4.5. Color, black and white, high-speed black and white, but you know what's even cooler? They have the Instax cameras and film. The Instax Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instax Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instax Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com. DR5 for the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out. www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet. Or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output, but they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high-resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain-free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And, of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com, the camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks, the community for analog photography, www.apug.org, and of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org, the place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in their museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it, they have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. In this issue of Inside Analog Photography Radio, today we're going to have with us John Reuter with 20 by 24 Studios in Tribeca, New York City. John is the purveyor of the 20 by 20 Polaroid camera, one of the only ones left on the planet. He's got all the film. These guys are rocking with the most unbelievable large format camera you've ever seen in your life, one of the most historic large format process cameras ever to be developed, and a really deep history and just beautiful stuff that you can achieve with this camera. You know, you can still rent this thing. It's unbelievable. We're going to talk to John about this today, what's going on with the studio, what he's been up to, his beautiful photography. He does some unreal work. You got to check this out. Definitely check out their website. John, how's it going today, buddy?
I'm great, Scott. How you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to see you on the program talking about yourself, your photography, probably the greatest camera ever made, the 20 by 24 Polaroid, and all the great stuff you're doing.
Yeah, as you know, we've had an interesting year trying to, I wouldn't call it to save the Polaroid 20 by 24 camera, but to sort of keep it going. We've managed to be very lucky in the transition out of Polaroid, and we found an investor who's going to help us create a new company. So that's kind of what I've been up to the last year.
Let's talk about your photography, how John got into photography, and we'll work it up to today. But tell me about your original interest in photography.
Yeah, I started shooting when I was in high school. I was given a 35mm camera as a gift as I graduated. And I had some friends who had a dark room, and over that summer, I started printing. And when I went on to undergraduate school, I kept the interest. I actually sought out a job at the yearbook at my college at Geneseo, and that led to a photo teacher the recommendation of the editor that year. His name is Mike Terrez, who was a great influence on me, a really great artistic photographer, and he inspired me to make photography my life. And I actually went on to graduate school at the University of Iowa and received an MFA, so I'm actually able to teach on the university level, although unfortunately I've never done that full time. But a huge change also with my work was the sort of the coming into my life of Polaroid material, and that came with SX70 in the early 70s. And I started doing a whole series of what I called SX70 constructions, where I actually took the film apart and peeled some stuff out. I would put in collage material, painted material, and make almost these tiny little paintings. That actually got the attention of Polaroid when I was in graduate school at the University of Iowa in the 70s. Got my degree finally and got out. I ended up moving to Boston, and that's where I came into contact with Polaroid yet again, and when I started actually working for them, first in a research studio and then on to the 20x24 in 1980. So I've been involved with the 20x24 camera as a photographer and a manager and now the owner of this company that is keeping it alive for close to 30 years.
So let's talk about what brought you from Iowa to Boston.
Well, I was from the East Coast at the time. I lived in New York since I was 14 in the late 60s, and I went to undergraduate school upstate. While I was in graduate school, my family moved to California, and so my first wife's family was still based in New York. And I had been to Boston to actually visit Polaroid while I was in graduate school to show them the work, and they loved it, and they bought some, gave me camera support and everything through the rest of my career. And so when it came time to leave Iowa, we wanted to come back to the East Coast, and it's funny, my first wife didn't want to be that close to her parents in New York, so we chose Boston instead. One thing led to another, and a great friend of mine, Rosie Purcell, turned me on to some job openings that were happening at Polaroid in that fall of 1978. Through a whole series of interviews that took months and months, I finally landed a job there.
So let's talk about Polaroid in 1978. At that time, things were pretty rocking.
It was. It was almost the Apple of its day or the Adobe of its day. It was cutting edge. People wanted their products. They had a very great PR department, and their ads were always award-winning. Their marketing was excellent, and it was really a hip and cool place to work then. And it's been interesting to see that change over the years. But yeah, when I came upon them, it was the Apple of its day. And it was a place that I really wanted to work because I just thought it was a really cool place.
Tell me about any interactions you had with Dr. Lan.
I only met him briefly. And to my sort of regret now, I had two job choices when I came into Polaroid. One was this research studio, which I eventually chose. And the other was 20x24, which was just starting up. And for a variety of reasons, I didn't take it. My only regret is that had I taken that job at that point in time, I would have had more close relations with Dr. Lance. So I met him a few times, had brief conversations with him, enough to see that he was an incredible genius, but I do really regret that I didn't get to spend the time that I would have with him. On the other hand, I ended up meeting my wife because of the other job, and I wouldn't have my children today, so you have to weigh those kind of personal and professional issues. But I do have still a little bit of regret that I didn't get more time with Land. That would have been cool, because he was such an amazing guy.
Tell me about the position being in the research laboratory, in the research studio. What did you do in a research studio Polaroid? Did you test out new emulsions?
Exactly, yeah. It was all films all the time. Everything from SX70 to 4x5 Polacolor to Type 55 PM, 8x10, which had just come out when I joined the company. And I would work with some of the scientists who made the film and just spend time sitting with them, and we'd go over all the sensitometry and stuff, which I didn't totally understand it, but I learned a lot from that. And actually, in making the films and everything, it really enlightened me quite a bit. I almost think it was like going to the minor leagues before finally taking the 20x24 job in 1980. So I was there about 2 years, and I learned a lot, learned all the formats, got comfortable with studio lighting and all those kind of things. Because when I was in graduate school, most academic situations, you do your aesthetic work, and there really isn't a lot of technical background in a fine art program that's teaching you to be a teacher, essentially. So for me to get that background was essential later on, and it pays dividends to this day in terms of my understanding of the film and how to do a test if things go wrong with your film. And of course, we're at a point where we have to resuscitate the reagent manufacturer for 20x24, and a lot of those skills will come into play as we figure out what to do and what chemistry to do. And my interactions also with some of my former Polaroid colleagues who are going to consult with me and help me make these new pods. The pods are everything, which contain the developer or the reagent, as we call it.
So tell me about the original 20x24 camera was basically cooked up. Dr. Lan had told his people, I want this thing made in a weekend. I need it by Monday.
Pretty much. In 1976, Lan was sort of renowned for his very over-the-top shareholders meetings. And in this day and age, shareholder meetings for most corporations are these very dry things. where they're showing spreadsheets and maybe there's some proxy voting going on. But Land Use It is a big show. And at this point in time, this followed the great success of SX-70, which came out in 72. So it was about 4 years later. They'd made a few changes, some cameras, but there really was no huge change in SX-70, so they needed some kind of splashy thing. And Polaroid was for the first time going to go from a 4x5 format, which was the largest professional film they made in both black and white and color, to 8x10. Now, it wasn't like they suddenly made a larger negative. A lot of people don't realize that Polaroid and most film manufacturers, when they make their negative and their positive, they make it very large. In Polaroid's case, the negative web was 60 inches and the positive web was 44 inches, so it always could have been done. The main thing is the audacity to think that you would want it in that large format. So Land said, all right, we're going to do 8x10, but why not really make an impact and let's see how big we can make it. So not only did the 20x24 get created at that point in time, but they also made a larger camera called the 40x80, which used the entire positive web. So it couldn't be 60 inches because the positive was only made 44. So it was 44 inches, which with all the seams on the side and everything, when you take that part away, it gives you a 40-inch wide image. And even though it was called 40x80, which it was, I think, because that sounded good, it actually had a bed that was 40x96 inches. So you could do a much larger picture. And the initial purpose that Polaroid had was to replicate master paintings from the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And it sort of showed off the resolution of the film, the color capabilities, which, quite honestly, were somewhat limited compared to a painter's palette. But still, these things were gorgeous, and that's what they showed to the shareholders in 76, was a lot of painting replicas, and they also did a live portrait from the stage at the shareholders' meeting, and sort of wowed everybody and got the enthusiasm behind the project. And that led to Polaroid themselves building 5 initial cameras, these standalone all-in-one cameras, one of which we still have in our studio in New York, over a period of time in 1977 and 78. So that really was the beginning of the project based on that.
So let's move in when John went to 2024. You were in the research lab in the studio testing out emulsions and all kinds of cool pack films and all kinds of stuff. How did you get into going, hey, we want you to come over here and work on this gig?
Yeah, when I didn't take the job, they hired one guy, a photographer who only lasted 6 or 7 months. And then they were sort of doing it by committee. There actually were 6 people who were trained to run a camera. And that doesn't mean that they necessarily understood photography and photographers and aesthetics. We actually had some issues in the early days where some of the technical people didn't understand some of the things that photographers wanted to come in and do, and actually sort of would stand there and argue with them as to whether it was worth doing or not, which, of course, was a huge mistake. So by the time we started hearing, gosh, it would be great if we can get John back. So for me, at that point, it was about a year and 9 months or so, and I pretty much learned everything that I thought I could learn, and I figured, all right, we'll give it a go this time. What was interesting was Polaroid themselves wanted to take it from a research element, which cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in those early days. I mean, I envy the budgets that they had. I mean, they dwarf what we do today in terms of the dollars that were spent. But they wanted it to start to make money, so they moved it into an advertising group, and that's when I joined in the summer of 1980. And so our charge then was to take it down to New York City for the first time and try to open it up to professional photographers, ad agencies, and people like that. So that was my first experience. So it was really a trial by fire. I didn't get much time to learn the camera in Boston before we went down, and I literally had to go down there and all by myself had to run this camera in front of people like Jay Mizell and other photographers who were coming in to see it. It was a little tough at first. A lot of learning, a lot of changes. People don't realize that besides the sheer size of the camera itself, which weighs 235 pounds, there's a lot of physical adjustments and roller alignments and things that go into a giant peel-apart Polaroid that you never experience in smaller formats. So there's a lot of nuance and things that if you don't understand at first, you can really be burned. And I got burned a little bit, but certainly learned a lot, and over time was able to get control of the camera and make it work for people. Sort of also from an aesthetic point of view, because I had training as an artist, I think from the collection program, it was just much nicer to have someone who really understood and never challenged or questioned people's art. It was not like, why do you want to do this, but what can we do to make this happen for you? So we really changed the program in a lot of respects by having me come over.
So let's talk about that in your initial times. Tell me your most horrifying experience. You're in with this new camera. They ditch you and drop you off in New York City and say good luck. What was the most horrifying experience with that camera in the early transition?
Well, and this is so esoteric, and only people who run a camera will understand this, but it was controlling the gap. Now, people don't understand gap with Polaroid so much because with the film that you get in pack film or used to get in 4x5 or 8x10, had a predetermined gap by these little spacers they put in there. It was called a mask and rail. But the 20x24 was a completely open system, and so it had none of that stuff. And we made changes later on, but the early cameras, it was just by the spring pressure that it could work or not. And if the gap was fine, everything looked good. You'd see a Polaroid as you're accustomed to. But if the gap was bad or off, you would have this horrific red model that would run through it. It looked like someone had spray-painted red paint on parts of the image. And trying to present that to these high-level photographers or ad agencies, which when they see that, they walk out the door. They'll say, what's the point of this? And so learning that, I'll never forget this phone call I had with a former Polaroid engineer named Alan McLean, with like my hand on the phone and my head in the camera, like tweaking these knobs and all of that. Because I think we had like a half an hour to go before I had the big demo coming up. So that was one of the earliest terrors. The other terrors are any time Polaroid put me on live television with a camera. You're just totally asking for trouble. It's like taking a tiger onto the set of a live program. You just don't know what's going to happen. The first time we went on the Today Show, for instance, my boss at the time, Roger Gregoire, goes and shoots the crew of the Today Show before I had a chance to bring the film down. Now, in our camera, you don't put a film cassette in. You actually pull the string and put it down. So he shoots it before I had the chance to even get the film down. So I have to sheepishly come around the corner and say, we're going to have to do that again. And, of course, Willard Scott got a hoot out of it and that kind of stuff. And those sort of things, to me, were just pure torture. Because even though it was great for Polaroid, it sort of, to me, kind of undermined what we felt was the serious aesthetic of our beautiful, big, large-format camera. And here we were just taking crazy pictures with it. And then years later, I was on the Today Show again before Christmas, and some producer decided to put us outside in December because she wanted the Christmas tree as a background. And I tried to explain to her that if I'm not lighting the tree is not going to show up. It's going to be black back there. So there's no point in putting me out here. We should be in the studio. And she says, no, we want to be there. We'll make sure the tree is lit. You know, and she didn't know what she was talking about. So this was close to Christmas, and we get out there, and it's 26 degrees. And anybody who knows instant film knows that it wants to be 72 degrees out there. So it was funny because there were Polaroid people watching. And you know how the Today Show will put the temperature in the lower corner?
Right.
So they're seeing it says 26 degrees, and they see me kind of smiling out there. They say, man, he's going to get killed. He doesn't know what's going on. But we'd been running hair dryers in there between the commercials and all that, and just trying to get it up, and finally did a shot, and was about half a stop underexposed because we lost so much speed, and it was blue and all that. But on TV, it looked great. In pre-HD TV, if you had an image, you looked like a hero. But that kind of stuff just used to kill me. And again, it was all about Polaroid, which I was happy to do. I mean, we worked for Polaroid then. But it really wasn't about the serious instrument we know this camera to be.
And no horrifying experiences with an individual photographer?
Well, there have been moments, and I would never name names, of course. But for the most part, we always work it out. I'm a pretty easygoing person. I'm a middle child, so I've always gotten along with most people. In fact, I used to have a friend in Boston in the early days. He ran a framing business, and it was like the contest was that you could get along with anybody. And you kind of have to, because there's no point in ruining their day, your day, or in the case of if Polaroid was sponsoring them, or if it was an ad shoot or an agency or something like that. You just couldn't be in the way of any of that stuff happening. So you had to be flexible, and you had to work things out with people. And fortunately, I can say that we almost always did.
So, John, let's move forward. You ran the studio in New York City for many, many years. Let's go through that.
We moved down from Boston to New York in 86. I was actually very anxious to move personally because I wanted to sort of be in New York, miss New York, and I felt Boston was a little sort of constrained, not only for me personally and artistically, but for the studio as well. It was pretty obvious that if we were going to make a commercial go of it, then you had to have a big presence in New York. So we did that in 86. And Polaroid, at that time, was still fairly active with their artistic program and sponsored a lot of people like David Leventhal, Timothy Greenfield Sanders, Joyce Tennyson. And these people ended up becoming some of our biggest commercial clients. With Timothy, we got a huge campaign with Barney's in the late 80s. And David did a lot of museum work. And Joyce Tennyson, of course, probably did the most commercial work ever done with the camera. Things from the Pirelli calendar to Connoisseur magazine and Pearl companies. I mean, it was pretty amazing, some of the commercial stuff we did in that period. As time went on, it was interesting. A lot of that kind of faded. I think the commercial world tends to regard certain things as a fad, and you used for a while. But the most enduring part of the business turned out to be those same people doing their fine artworks. So either getting museum shows or, in a case like a guy like William Wegman, a huge response and gallery sales and things like that. So that led to kind of a self-sustaining system where people that Polaroid supported in the early days really clicked with it, and it really jumped their careers in certain directions. And it just sort of kind of came back and benefited us by the fact that they continued to work with us, and we got the rentals from that. So, because it was very clear at a certain point that Polaroid wanted this to be self-sustaining, a break-even sort of situation, which we pretty much were after about 2 years of moving down to New York. And that stayed fairly consistent up and down through different economies and everything all the way through. So we've always managed to do well.
So you've worked with some incredible photographers with this camera, from Andy Warhol to Annie Leibovitz, but you've had some pretty cool experiences working with some of these people.
Yeah, it's really been a privilege because as an artist, and I would never even put myself into the class of being peers with any of these people, but
oh, no, you are.
Well, the relationship you have with another artist when you work together is very different from, like, going out and having drinks and talking about the work that you do or dropping by their studio and seeing what they're doing and that sort of thing. Because you're solving problems together and you're working on their imagery, and of course, from my perspective, it's a huge sort of universe of imagery and approaches and things. You get to know an artist in a way that you just would never get to by conversation or trading tips or anything like that. When you're actually making pictures together, there's an understanding and a bond and a relationship that I don't think most artists get to experience unless they do collaborative work with another person. And rarely would someone be collaborative with a couple dozen really great artists. So that's been a real privilege to be able to bring that to them. And the biggest equivalence I can have is kind of like an atelier where there's a master printer who runs the lithography presses or the etching presses or whatever. But it's a little different in that at the same time, you're almost like a cinematographer because you're advising the photographer or the director on the lighting and the film stock and the filtration and all those things. So to me, it's always been like a combination of a cinematographer or a DP, director of photography, and a master printmaker. Because you are deciding on the shot, and you're printing it at the same time. So it's a parallel that is similar, but it's unique in its own way, because there is no other process. Given the scale and the kind of lighting that you need, it's not like you just do available light or you have a small strobe. I mean, there's just substantial lighting, 20,000 watt seconds of very expensive, in our case, Braun color lighting that we do that not a lot of people have an understanding of, particularly in the power amount and trying to coax nuance out of a main light that's firing 12,000 watt seconds.
I'm quite aware of that. I remember when they went off when you shot my photo.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
I mean, it's great, and I still think that with all of the great films there are, and there's this digital technology that you cannot beat instant photography. There's something about it. I have this addiction at this point with instant photography. I don't get it, but it's an amazing technology, and it's just too cool.
It is. It's getting better with the larger screens on the back of cameras, but you're not going to pass around your 5D Mark II to like 8 people. Let them see the picture you just took. You can hold on to that and show them. But it's the one thing to hand a photo where they can put it in their own hand, and it's much more personal than that. And just the nature of the document, the limitations of the medium in some respects, people now kind of revere it because it's not perfect. It'll have reciprocity shifts in color if you do extended daylight shooting, where it'll go all blue, and people will love that. So it responds in ways that digital's kind of fixed all that with your ability to either pick a color balance, or if you shoot raw, you can change it later. It's kind of neat to still have a material that will be what it is at the moment that you shot it. I love digital, too. I've embraced photographic technologies on almost every level. And I've found sort of quirky, painterly things to do with digital that perhaps other artists wouldn't. Just the same way that I kind of found my own voice with Polaroid early on when I did those constructions, and then later with my transfer work that I was doing 4x5 foot transfers by ganging them together and painting them with pastels and dry pigment and things like that. I've kind of found similar ground in digital as well, just always trying to look for the things that sort of inform my aesthetic. What I think the real danger of digital is if you don't have an aesthetic and you're riding totally on its technical perfection. And you could make the perfect histogram of the most boring picture in the world and the perfect color balance. And it's sure, it's 21 megapixels, and you could print it 60 by 80 inches, but who cares? It's not an interesting picture. And so for people who rely on that technology to sort of overcome an aesthetic ability, I think are just wrong. And would they be a good analog photographer? Probably not. But for some reason, people think that digital has defeated those kind of steps in the way of bad photography, and it hasn't at all. You can still make very bad, perfect photography.
I think it's more difficult to shoot instant film, either it be Polaroid stock, the Fuji stock, I don't care who makes it. It's even more difficult to nail a great picture than it is to shoot chrome.
Oh, for sure. It's more limited than transparency, absolutely. The range of that print is less than a transparency, and you don't have any development correction with it. Like if you made a mistake on a transparency shoot, and let's say you did a clip test, you could pull it or push it anywhere from a quarter stop to a full stop or whatever. With Polaroid, you can't really develop forward or backwards to overcome any of that. Once you shoot it, it is what it is. Now you can maybe change the contrast and then the color balance slightly by going longer in processing. But it is kind of the ultimate high wire. Its main saving grace, of course, is that you get to print right away, so you have another chance if you have another chance. If you don't, you better have had your act together when you do it. Or you have to embrace the serendipity, as we call it, where you have to go with what you've got. But to me, I think it always instilled a freedom and a discipline at the same time. The freedom in knowing, particularly with a large scale like 20 by 24, all right, we're going to see it. We're going to know what we got. And if the client's willing or the artist's willing, we'll make a second shot. But the discipline to get them with a large format image within a third of a stop, like right away, that was always my goal. And working in the studio, you get to know your lights pretty well. And I've always been a real fan of mixed light photography. So loving to do shutter drag, to burn in window images when we have strobes going on, that's always been a favorite thing of mine. And I would often work for a long time without a meter, just because I knew the lights so well, and I would look at how far away they were. And granted, these were softboxes, not open reflectors or anything, but I could just sort of sense and just know, just having worked with it so much, that I could get within a third of a stop or better. And a third of a stop to some people may sound like a lot, but it's not with instant film. If you're off by a third, it can look bad. If it's too dark or too light by a third.
Well, you're done. Like you said, it's less forgiving than transparency than chrome.
Yeah, I mean, in the studio, our divisions are down to a sixth of a stop. We often will call exposures like 45 and a sixth or 32 and 5/6, and people would laugh and say, why don't you just say a third? And I'd say, well, because it's not a third, it's a sixth. It needs to be that. You could maybe cut a little bit finer, but let's not get silly. A sixth of a stop is pretty small.
No, but I mean, it's a fine art in doing this stuff, and I think it's even much more difficult running this 20 by 24. Let's talk about here real quick before we get into what's going on here currently and stuff. I want to talk about your art. You've done, like you said, some really beautiful transfers. You had shot stuff and then reshot it on 20 by 24 and made instant monster image. I mean, you've done some crazy stuff with this medium.
I have, yeah. And one of the reasons that I didn't take the job when I was offered it in 1978 is I was doing my painted SX-70 constructions at the time. And I'll never forget walking into the studio, seeing this giant camera. And at the time, all the guys who ran it wore these blue, not ankle length, but like calf length lab coats. Oh, I don't think so. Not only the camera. I just said, how can I possibly, A, conceive of this for myself and run it for others? But the main thing was, I wasn't really into pure, knock-em-dead color photography, just straight photography. I was really more of a painterly kind of person. So I think my first rejection was because of that. So what I needed to find was my own personal voice. And it actually took several years. I mean, I started on the job in 1980, and I don't think I had what I considered successful images with that camera till late 83, early 84, so almost 3 years. And when I look back at it now in terms of the aesthetic, in retrospect, achieved, it was really 1987. So 7 years before I figured out where I fit in with the camera. And I love what I did over that period. I think it is some of the most unique Polaroid transfer imagery certainly ever done. And it was way before anybody else was doing image transfer with the camera. I mean, I kind of jealously guarded it for a while until I couldn't stop it anymore. And had a difficult time at first when other artists wanted to do transfer, but finally got past that. And for me, it was taking it in a painterly direction. As I said before, I would divide an image into four parts, and I would shoot it in sections. And so then I would glue these onto big canvas panels, and so my transfers were 42 by 52 inches. On the smallest ones, and I actually made four or five of them, that were nine-panel transfers that were 5.5 by 6.5 feet. Reworked very strongly with the image transfer. I was often a fan of when the process failed and there'd be gaps missing from it, and all that just fed into it. So for me, it was always trying to find a way to make it unique to me. And I think I succeeded in those years. As a result, I actually stopped doing them in 97 when digital started to work a lot more for me. Yeah, I'd actually been working digitally from an image composition point of view since the early 90s. 92 was some of my first digital collages. And for years, I printed them out to Polaroid film and made transfers and reworked them and everything. I got to a point in 97 where I was actually starting to like iris printing a little bit more. What I've been thinking of very seriously lately, and in fact, I did a mock-up earlier this week in the studio, is going back and revisiting those four-panel transfers. And doing them now with sort of the advent of digital technology, I can divide up my picture into four a lot easier. Believe it or not, the way I used to do it in the old days was to take the chrome of a collage, 4x5 transparency, and just with the sleeve that you had, that transparency would come in, I would just make the grid across and divide it in four parts. And I would use a Cinar camera with the front standard and just slide it around until I got the frame in there. Very crude and everything. It worked. But now I would take advantage of how easily I can divide an image into four parts and just create these things. And so the photographic part of it will be quite easy. But for me, it would be interesting. So it's over 12 years since I've done these four-panel transfers. And just to see where it'll go. I mean, cause it can never be what it was, because even when I would work like 6 months apart and try to continue a body of work, I was always in a different place when I got there, and so I'll be very curious to see what it's like now. The reasons that I would do it now is, well, of course, I can do it all digitally. I mean, because a lot of my recent work has been doing prints out on canvas that I put on panels, and I'm doing encaustic painting on them and things like that. But it's definitely a unique look. I mean, I actually had a show a few years ago at the University of Hartford where I had some of the digital collages that I was doing on canvas at the time and shown with the 20 by 24 four panels. It was real interesting for me as an artist to see that. It was pretty cool.
Let's talk about your teachings and what you've been doing here recently before we get into the current situation with 2024 and all the great stuff that's happening there. You've started playing around with digital. Tell me, you've been teaching. You were doing a bunch of Photoshop stuff. Tell me what Johnny's been doing since, let's say, the last transfer.
Yeah, I've had the privilege of teaching at the International Center of Photography since 1985. A lot of it was the transfer workshops at first. And when they went digital in 95, they invited me to do a Photoshop class. I've been doing it every year since then. I've been doing more Lightroom lately, but I've also taught at Santa Fe in the main media workshops, and I do quite a bit at the Palm Beach Photographic Center. So for me, I love teaching, number one, and I feel I know Photoshop really well. I've been doing it since version 2.5, and so I've learned over the years and had a podcast on for a while, which actually, even though I've stopped since January, it's still one of the top 10 rated podcasts, which is nice. I get emails all the time of people asking me, why aren't you doing this for free anymore? I say, well, you got it right there. I got too much to do right now with 20 by 24. So unfortunately, I've had to kind of cut back a little bit on my teaching. I did do my residency in Singapore in April, which I loved, working for 2 weeks with high school students, a mixture of analog and digital, and loved doing that. But this summer, I didn't actually put in for any workshops at Maine or Santa Fe, and even ICP I've cut back just because I know I have to focus for this period of time to get this business running. And the amount of energy and focus and things required right now is extraordinary. And so I'm putting it all into that right now. I think I do have a transfer workshop at the end of the year at ICP, but that's the only one. So once I made the commitment to my investor, I said, I'm going to do this. And even though I'm not doing all the stuff I love doing, it's temporary to me. Once we get through this, I'll be back teaching and kind of can't wait for that because I do love it so much. It's also great because it forces me back into my own work. This does not right now. As I joked with friends that I'm using my Canon 5D Mark II and Lightroom and all these things to make panoramas of my pod machine. It's like I'm photographing industrial equipment. That's all I'm shooting right now. And as the move of the studio and everything takes place, that's my only chance to make photographs. But I do make the most of it. Probably some of the best pictures of pod machines that have ever been taken, if I do say so myself.
And I guess hopefully at one point here we're going to see a class on the operation of the 20 by 24 cameras. Is there going to be some historical class that's going to take place?
That's a good question. Through the years, we've had requests to do it, and we've done a couple workshops out in Santa Fe with it. And the biggest problem I've always felt with teaching and 20 by 24, 20 by 24 is really a one-on-one situation. When you have a class of 8 to 10 people, to me, their access is so diminished compared to what I know it should be. That I feel frustrated as a teacher, get an hour and a half, and to me that's not enough. An observatory class perhaps is better, but it'd have to be almost like a 10-week thing, and we do have some venues where that happens. I mean, my earliest venue with the camera was at the Museum School in Boston when we left the Polaroid property in the early 80s, and I loved doing that. That was a 10 or 15-week class, I forget what it was, and I don't know, I had 7 or 8 students, and you got to work with them over a period of time. And they would, in the end, have a full 1 or 2 days of work. And so, to me, that would be the best way to do that. And we currently have a camera still at the Mass College of Art in Boston, and a very fine photographer named Katero Yashoika teaches that class. He actually was one of my students at the Museum School in 1982, and so he's continued that venue. I mean, I would love to do that, but realistically, I just don't have time to do that, but it would be great in the end. But I'd be happy to have that passed on and have someone like a Tracy Storer or Katero continue that tradition, or even bring it to like main media workshops in the summer where you have a week-long class of that. I mean, I'm very interested in keeping those support levels going with the new company. We're not Polaroid, certainly not Polaroid in its heyday. We're a very small company. But I do remember the excitement of bringing it to people who aren't really wealthy or have backers or something like that. And we're going to keep that going for sure, because to me that's where a lot of the energy comes from with the camera, is having people who have nothing to lose. I mean, it's the risk aversion is one of the worst things you can have when working on this camera, so it'll be great for me to continually get new blood. We're definitely going to have an active program in that regard. Obviously, we just need to get through these next few months and getting everything set up and under control and back into a normal production where I can start to make decisions based on that, where I'm not worrying about, did the electrician wire the pod machine correctly today? And that's kind of what I'm going through right now.
Or I guess you can just come to 2024 Studios in beautiful Tribeca and rent the camera and you can have personal instruction.
For sure, and that is the best thing. It's a very unique day. You don't just walk into an empty studio and they drop off your film and your camera in a box and you got to put it all together. It's certainly a collaborative and supportive experience where we work with you in advance if we know what you want to shoot and try to make sure that we have the right seamless for you, whatever kind of coffee or tea or whatever you like, and just make it a really comfortable day. There's a huge service component to what we offer that kind of stands apart from even your average rental experience. Much more like a lithography shop, a studio where people are really there for you and kind of waiting to see what direction you want to take them in. So yeah, we're very service-oriented there, and it's a great learning experience for a lot of people, I think. And it's always a great experience for us, because every new artist is a learning experience for the operator, too. It's different all the time.
It's a very unique experience, and I think people should dig deep and try this at least once. And I think we've stated this before, this is basically a very historic camera, a very historic process, and one of the great pieces of analog technology left that's in existence in the whole planet. I mean, it's something you can't just go do.
No, and now we're the only source of the original Polaroid film right now. Pretty much most of the stock that Polaroid sent out in 2008 in April on through the end of the year is pretty much getting to the end. You're still finding it on eBay and whatnot, but we've got the real stuff. And we'll be making new reagent for it, so we'll keep it fresh for the next 3 or 4 years. So we're kind of in a unique position of not only having, A, the remaining stock, but the ability to keep it looking as fresh as it did the day that Polaroid shipped their last film. And we have access to the scientists and the engineers, and so we can continue to tweak certain things, because as film ages, you have to make certain adjustments. And we'll be able to make those adjustments to keep it looking perfect, and that's our goal. And even compared to Fuji, which I admire Fuji a lot for being in the market, I think they make a beautiful film. They don't make large format. They haven't shown a lot of interest in even going beyond 4x5. A lot of people had high hopes they would do 8x10, and they seem to be reluctant to do that. And then if you even compare us to The Impossible Project, and I know Florian Kapps very well, and we are in constant contact and have dinner every now and then, he also has a different situation because he's now trying to recreate with new technology or available technology the spirit of Polaroid film, but it's not going to be the original Polaroid film. And we've got that. We've got the last of the original Polaroid film, so we're in a pretty unique and special situation. And we offer it in a format that few people get a chance to work with, so we feel we're in a pretty special place.
So, John, let's move fast forward. Everything's going cool in the studio. You guys are renting stuff, shooting portraits, doing high fashion, doing this great stuff. And I think one day you get a call from corporate headquarters with not a very happy message.
Yeah, it actually goes back a lot further than a lot of people think. Polaroid declared bankruptcy first in 2001, and we kind of thought that was the end of the game, and it turned out not to be at all. That actually was just a small blip on the horizon. They emerged from bankruptcy, they were bought by another company, and had changes of bureaucrats above us and everything. But the studio really was kind of immune, partly because we were in New York City and Polaroid was in Massachusetts. But things really started to get difficult in 2004. And this was as the original people, Bank One Equity Partners, were prepping Polaroid to be sold yet again to Petters, and they wanted to purge the salary rolls of everyone. And so it was a massacre. I think it was in the fall of 2004. I was actually getting ready to go on to a roadshow trip with my boss, Stuart Strong, at the time, taking the 20x24 down, and we'd go to these places. I think we were going to Alexandria, Virginia. And the call came in as we were driving to this event that we both had been laid off. And Polaroid had actually laid off 21 of their 26 marketing managers around the country and sort of had made a decision that they were not going to put any more money into marketing peel-apart film or professional films, that they were just going to kind of let them run out and just sell them out and that sort of thing. So that really was the beginning of the end, and it's a lot earlier than most people know of. From that point forward, I kind of knew that Polaroid was going to get out of the film business as early as that. And we were kind of like quarter to quarter for a long time, and that was very disconcerting to keep the business going. We had a lot of people coming into the studio thinking it was the last time. And a lot of our clients would joke with us. We kept saying, well, we think this is going to be it. And, of course, the quarter goes by, the year goes by. But by the end of 2006, early 2007, There was a very concrete plan in Polaroid to phase out of the analog film business. At that time, they still had high hopes for what became the Zinc technology, the Zero Ink thing. They had these kiosks that they were going to do that suddenly they canceled. There was a lot of tumult going on with all these people that came in when the company was sold. And then Petters, when he took it over, Tom Petters, who was a brand licensee guy for TVs, he kind of worked off the recommendations of this bank equity group that said you should get out of the analog business. So they started the process of the wheels turning that made this inevitable and, in the end, irreversible. The New Bedford factories were closed down, I believe, in 2005, so they made their last runs. All of this was never made public because Polaroid didn't want their customers to know they were getting out of the film business. Because they were afraid that people would say, well, I don't want your film anymore if you're not going to sell it. When in fact, as we all know, the complete opposite was true in the end when they finally announced. People freaked out so much there was just a run on everything. So who knows if they had sort of intimated that they were thinking of that back then, if there would have been reactions that maybe would have allowed them to continue longer or downsize or pick one factory to do it or even do in the U.S. what Impossible Project is doing in the Netherlands. Because we had several smaller factories that could have been adapted to continue. So there's still a lot of debate. I mean, I talked to some Polaroid vice presidents who said that the biggest problem with Polaroid was it was like a big cruise ship. And when you had 4,000 people riding the ship at a certain price point, it was great. You made money on it and everything. But by the end of the game, we had 400 people on that cruise ship. But it was still the same size ship. You had to take it out in the ocean. It needed as much fuel to run and crew to keep it safely run and everything. And they said there was a point where it just crossed into a lack of sustainability. And so those things started early. And it was very difficult for me, knowing the truth about this and not really being able to even talk to our clients about it, what the reality was that we were getting out of the business and everything. The only other benefit of that was such an early lead on that is I had time within the company to work with some really great people to make sure we had the materials set aside, an adequate amount. People ask, well, why did you only get 500 cases worth? The truth is, at current consumption, or even a generous consumption, it's about as much film as you can run through 20 by 24 cameras worldwide before the stuff is going to physically start to deteriorate. And so to have gotten, say, 1,000 or 2,000 cases, which at a certain point in time perhaps could have been possible, it just would have been more material than you could actually consume before it started to go bad. Because the positive is the weak link, and the negative is virtually indestructible. You freeze it and everything. But the positive will deteriorate no matter what after about 4 years. It either gets brittle or certain characteristics of it start to change. So you couldn't go beyond that window. So that's why we ended up with the amount of material that we did. But we did. So it was all set aside. We had the machinery set aside. It's a very complicated process. I mean, I started this process, and I've been photographing things in the old Waltham factory since 2008. Where we identified we need this reactor to make reagent and this homogenizer to finish it. Okay, I'm going to need that spooling machine, and I'm going to need the pod machine, which is the critical machine that takes the reagent from the tanks when we make it and actually puts it into that pod. Now, I mean, we joke about pods because it's such a funny name and everything, but it totally is the key to success of this, is being able to get that reagent into that little foil packet so that it's usable over a sustained period of time. And that's the challenge that we're just about to set up right now. I mean, it's taken me all summer to find spaces and the right way to move things in. And we're just about to move ahead in the next couple of weeks of having the pod machine operational, the spooler operational, and then the last part will be the reactor. We've actually contracted out to a company that already makes chemistry. So if they do this all the time, and I don't have to maintain my own facility to keep all this going. So we're in a good place there because it really reduces the overhead of doing that, and we only have to make stuff when we need to. So keep our fingers crossed that we've done all this right.
So what was the thoughts of the bankruptcy court when you guys were actually able to make an agreement with the so-called Polaroid Corporation, what was actually left of not really the original Polaroid, but the swine that's in jail now for fraud? But you guys were able to cut a deal with the bankruptcy guy. Did they figure pretty much that all those 20 by 24 film cameras and equipment was all garbage and you could have it for $50, just haul it out of the warehouse? Or was this a massive undertaking to be able to acquire this stuff with lots of money?
The latter. $50 would have been great, but it's multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars that we went into doing this. And our deal was actually done in March of 2008. And for a whole variety of reasons that I really can't go into publicly, there were delays caused by what ended up being Petter's situation. And ultimately, Petter's arrest for fraud and the Ponzi scheme and using Polaroid essentially as an ATM and all of these things, that we are very lucky in that all of our materials and things were held aside from that, partly because it was such a strange and different format. I mean, if we were doing pack film, perhaps we could have been totally burned and left out of the process. But because we were the only ones who wanted this at a certain point and had the knowledge and the wherewithal to make it happen, we sort of stood off the side of that and kind of under the radar as far as a lot of those considerations were happening. So there wasn't really a re-examination. It was just a deal that was in the pile, totally written up almost a year in advance, actually over a year in advance. And he just hit rubber stamp on it and said, sure, why not? And we were done. But we had to wait in the end over 6 months while the bankruptcy proceedings delayed. And they were focused, of course, on the big deal of the $68 million sale of I don't know what to the new people, the Gordon Brothers and Hilco. And, of course, that went through a lot of tumult because they thought they had one sale at, I forget what the initial offer was, maybe $30 million. But then they started bidding and going back and forth. But we always stood outside of that, and we were never at risk because it always was going to be approved or not, and it was sort of separate from all that. So fortunately, we didn't get caught up in any of those arguments or bidding and that kind of stuff. But it was just the sort of the torture of waiting all that time and not having access to materials. I mean, after a while, I mean, we had adequate supplies set aside that we were able to sell in the studio, but we started to run out of that by the end of the year, and then it went all the way to May. So we've had a lot of challenges that we just never expected. PEB, which is the remnants of Polaroid Corporation, I'm not even sure what PEB stands for. It's probably Polaroid something. They are beholden to the creditors. And so you have all these creditors that had loaned Petter's money or Polaroid money or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of complicated legal issues that I'm not even privy to. So it's not the guys who bought the Polaroid name. The collection, again, stood outside of that. So the dissolution or the auctioning of the collection will be solely to satisfy these creditors who are still getting pennies on the dollar. Because I think, I don't know what the claims were, $300 or $400 million, and the collection's going to generate at best $7 to $12 million. I mean, the whole collection issue is heartbreaking and difficult for a lot of artists. I mean, I have 100 pieces in the collection that go back from 1974 till, I don't know, my last ones were maybe around 2000. And I always gave my best stuff to Polaroid, so there's a lot of my best work that is now being valued at a sort of standard rate of like $100 an image. Which is insulting, but I'm thinking, hey, if it's going to be that, let me get it back somehow. And there's a lot of great artists who are in that same boat. There's been a lot of arguments and sort of opinions about what status an artist had when they worked with Polaroid as a supported artist for those many years. When people have examined it, they say, well, Polaroid didn't actually own the physical piece. They own the rights to put it in magazines and put on the website and that sort of stuff, but they didn't actually own the piece outright. But then you get a counter-argument that when Polaroid went bankrupt the first time, there's just so many legal issues right now. And we're very fortunate that a really great critic, A.D. Coleman, has sort of taken up the cause. And on his website called Photocritic International, for anyone who's interested in what's going on with the collection, he's sort of really championing the cause of the artists and everything. So my hat off to Alan for doing all that, because I'd love to be involved a lot more, but I just don't have time right now. So there's so many ramifications from the dissolution of this great company and all the great things that they did. It's just so sad to see all of that end, and maybe our vindication will be that we keep going and we support artists too at a certain point, and we just do new things, and the instant magic will continue through us. So that could be our best revenge, I guess, in the end.
I think so, and hopefully you'll get some of your artwork back too. Maybe they'll even sell it to you for $100 a piece. It's worth buying back yourself.
Exactly, yeah. There's a 9-panel transfer of mine that was the only one I ever mounted. I don't have room to keep these big pieces, but I would love to get back. There's a lot of great work that's so undervalued. They're looking at the creme de la creme, which, you know, granted is great pieces. There are Edward Weston's, Paul Caponegro's, Imogen Cunningham's, Harold Edgerton. The list goes on. And a lot of those aren't even Polaroids. They were things that Land was given by these artists because they were his friends. And then you have the Wegmans and the Leventhals and Chuck Close's and Rauschenberg's. Great pieces. But then you get to another level with Barbara Kasten, Sandy Feldman, Rosie Purcell, Olivia Parker. I could name 100 artists of really great work that's in the same B list as I'm on. It's just not right. What all the artists hope for is that perhaps this will all be consolidated and given to an institution or sold for a package price, and the work stays together, and that it's curated and that and studied as a unit, as this great relationship that a one-day corporation had with actual artists. To me, the most unique relationship of a corporate entity with creative people, maybe since the Medici. And then who knows all the issues you had with the Medici and Leonardo and those guys. Just having been part of it, I understand just how special that was and very different from what Kodak did. Even though Kodak underwrote a lot of great projects, and Ilford did, and others, and they sponsored workshops and institutions, the most powerful thing about the Polaroid relationship with its artists was really the one-on-one relationship between either someone like myself working with them or someone like Barbara Hitchcock, who curated the collection, and Elko Wolf and all these people. There was a lot of personal relationships where they encouraged people's careers and things in ways that I don't think you've seen anywhere else. And for me, that's really sad if that just gets spread to the wind and undervalued in the way that it seems to be tracking right now. But it's not over yet. We got some fighting to do and things, and hopefully we'll get past this.
Hopefully some rich person will buy it and give it to a museum or the George Eastman House or somewhere. We'll stay together.
There is a couple of venues where the Eastman House would be perfect for it. It could still happen. So we don't want to get too upset and too angry right now, because it is not over. And there's still a chance that good things could happen.
So true. Maybe some of these fat cats on Wall Street that are getting all their bonuses again can pull together and reclaim themselves and buy this stuff and get at least one karma coin back. Let's move forward here. You get a phone call on the day of Dr. Land's 100th birthday that says you got a half hour to come get this stuff. What happened?
Well, first I had to get a substantial amount of money transferred into Polaroid's bank account, which I did. I think one of my skills right now is getting money wired at the right time, which you think sounds easy, but it's really not. Our investor is great, but he's an incredibly busy man, a world traveler, and on any given day, you never know where he might be or what he's up to. He advises presidential commissions. I mean, the guy is pretty heavy duty. So for me to get his attention, substantial. And then I literally had to contract movers one day before the Polaroid warehouse was going to cease being under Polaroid's control. Their lease was up. And there was no way they were going to renew that lease and keep people on and everything. So, yeah, I could have maybe done a deal with the people who owned the building, but the Polaroid guards were leaving and the people who understood my stuff and all that. It was really critical that I got that stuff out of there. And I was very fortunate to find a great moving company called Radford Warehouse, or Radford Movers, who picked it up in one afternoon, and four tractor trailers full of stuff went out. So we stored it over the summer, and I quickly, as fast as I could, found facilities to house it all. I decided to, as I mentioned before, I'm contracting out to have the reagent made somewhere, so a couple of our machines go there. But then it was finding a home for not only a place to store the film, but also the pod machine and the spooler and all those. And I found this wonderful place in a little town called Putnam, Connecticut, which is kind of near Worcester, Mass. It's about an hour away from me, and the reason I put it there was to be close to the former Polaroid people who will work for us in the future. But this wonderful, it's an old thread factory and a mill called Belding Mill and a river. I mean, it's a very charming little town. And just the whole nature of all that, to me, is kind of nice to have go forward. Tomorrow I'm actually meeting the guy who used to run the pod machine. We have the electricity done. We want to make sure we wire it in the right directions so the machine doesn't run backwards. And all these kind of issues of my grasp to understand all that takes place. I really have to realize and let go that there's no way I understand all this stuff that's going on. And I do have to rely on a lot of my former colleagues and things. I mean, I've gotten a couple of the manuals of how to make developer and the pod machine, and this stuff's complicated. It's not easy. And you look at the list of chemicals, and it will just make your head spin in terms of the complexity of these things. And we got the easy part. The Impossible Project has to make the stuff up new. All I got to do is find the bag or the bin or the barrel of stuff and set it aside and mix it up again.
When you got this stuff from Polaroid, did they give you raw stock? Of course you got the formulas. I'm sure they said, here you go, Johnny. Good luck.
I thought the formulas would be the first thing they handed me, but I had to have my consultants dig. It cost me a little bit of money to do that in the end, but it had to be done. They were all on computers. Polaroid was at a point where they were starting to just purge and shut down all their computers, where they were just wiping, which is kind of scary. We have retrieved everything, and we're about to act on it now. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to be trying to make this stuff. So it's going to be interesting. We'll see if we got all the stuff we need. You look at the list, and there's one thing of looking at spreadsheets of what you got, and there's another thing of actually going to box number 121 and finding out that it's full or not. So we'll see.
So you got this stuff together. You're going to be able to make the pods, and the pods are these foil containment that are about, what, 20, 21 inches wide by, what, about an inch and a half tall?
About 20 inches by 1 inch tall. And we had gone for the last couple of years into a system where we did these multi-chamber pods, which, to make a long story short, were to help shipping the pods so they wouldn't break. And there were some unintended consequences of the way these chambers were made that caused premature aging of the film. So I'm going to abandon that for our New York production and most domestic production for sure. Go back to the old pods that we used for 27 years with no problems and things. We have control over that now. It's kind of great to know that. I mean, I just look at the switches on the machine and it says multi-chambered pod or not. I said, okay, not. From now on, that would be not, and hopefully it'll do that. You flip the switch and you hope it does not.
So, right.
We'll see. The machine is on our website, actually, if people want to follow from a news point of view. I've had a website that we've made for quite a while called www.20by24studio.com, and that would be 20x24, where I have things up to date about what's happening. There's a picture front and center of the pod machine, and it's quite a device. I mean, you don't see machines like this much anymore. It looks like some kind of bizarre reel-to-reel recorder, because on the end of it, there's these two huge things of pod foil, which becomes the pod, which is 2 inches wide at first, but the machine folds it and then puts it under these things. And quite honestly, I'm going to learn how it works because I never got a chance to see it in the old days. We'll be posting a video of that. When this thing starts pumping out pods, believe me, the world's going to see it.
No, I think it's really cool what you guys have cooking here. So let's talk about the availability of material. What stock do you have left? Is there black and white color, different kinds of color? What do you guys have left to shoot?
Yeah, I have actually a mix of all three. Unfortunately, or fortunately actually, we thought we had all the black and white made by Polaroid. And suddenly as I'm looking at these spreadsheets at the end, and also when I was looking at the last warehouse that Polaroid had, I found some black and white sheet. And then I go look at the spreadsheet, it says I've also got some black and white negatives. And when I did the numbers of the meters per roll, it looks like I've got perhaps 40 to 50 cases of black and white, which was a real surprise and great news. With color, I'm kind of evenly split between old school, what we call P3 or Polacolor ER, or it's what people used to know as 669, 59, or 809. We have about 250 or so cases of that. And then the other color film is what we now call P7, which last saw commercial product is type 690 Polacolor. It's the film that Polaroid always made to sort of match Fuji's color. It's a brighter, more vivid color film and everything. So we've got both of those, and down the road, we're open to more options. We certainly want to keep this going longer than what my current stock will do. Obviously, we want to take advantage of what we've got and preserve it and make it as best as possible to sell it while we have it. But down the road, we have several options, and one could be Fuji. I mean, we did talk to them early on in the process, and they expressed some interest, but given the delays that I went through and everything, there was no way to do that. So that could be a possibility. I'm by no means saying that's certain, but also Impossible Project may have some leads to make color negative going forward down the road as well. So these things will sort out over the next year or so. They'll be coming into production. And obviously, they want to continue 8x10. They ended up getting the 8x10 line. I was offered it, but we had no place for it. And it's very complicated machinery. If you saw it, you'd be frightened, and rightfully so. My pod machine is a piece of cake compared to this. So down the road, I mean, if they're able to make 8x10 instant color, then certainly we could go that way. So looking down 4 or 5 years, it could keep going for 10 years or longer. It really depends on demand and the market and what we do. But there is a potential to keep this going for substantially longer than just the window that we've secured with the material that we've just bought.
So let's talk about if you want to shoot this. I hear that your colleague, Tracy Storr, in California, that was originally working for Polaroid, has started to and actually has manufactured one brand new Polaroid-style 20x24 camera.
Yeah, he has, and that is amazing. Tracy also was my student at the museum school in 1982. So both he and Caterer were in that original class in the fall of 82. He's run a camera for us. He replaced me in Boston after a while. And he actually ended up moving out to San Francisco when Polaroid did a deal with Calumet to open a West Coast studio, which unfortunately didn't last too long, but Tracy stayed out there. And he's had a keen interest in large cameras, way more than I. Whenever I have true technical issues or questions about lenses or things like that, I always defer to Tracy, because he's really into it. And I've always felt that I'm kind of like the song Rocket Man. For all the science I don't understand, it's just my job 5 days a week. So I've never had the full technical dive into large format. I know how to do it, but I'm not as interested in the numbers. And Tracy really is. He's also a very good photographer. But this evolved, and eventually he made his own conventional 20x24 non-Polaroid camera about 2 or 3 years ago. He's been wanting to do one for quite a while. We did have a vendor, the Wisner Manufacturing Company, that made some portable cameras for us. He made one crack at an all-in-one, but unfortunately, he never made them to the specs that I wanted. And we had a lot of frustration with a lot of those units out in the field. And they've been serviceable, but hardly what our dream was. And when we got another vendor, well, Tracy is that vendor. So he got a chance with a client who's based in Paris, who asked to build an all-in-one. And the challenge he gave him was he wanted to be able to fly this machine around small countries in like Africa and South America. So he had to break it up into three pieces. The all-in ones that we have are made to be a singular unit, and they don't. They go into a very large crate that weighs, in the end, 600 pounds with the camera. So Tracy went to work, and he actually came out to my studio last spring, or early summer, and we took apart our 20 by 24, partly because I had found a virgin set of rollers at Polaroid in the last days, and decided I wanted to swap out and take out our rollers, which had done hundreds of thousands of exposures, and put in this fresh pair. So we completely stripped our camera down and took it apart. He did measurements and drawings and photos and all these things, put it back together in one afternoon, and we plugged it in, and the thing ran. Couldn't believe it. So he kind of took it from there, and huge project for one person. I think he learned a lot, certainly. But he made this beautiful camera, and again, it's on our webpage. We now have a blog page instead of a static HTML page. And so if you scroll down, you can actually see pictures of this camera. And in fact, I have it juxtaposed with the original prototype, our New York City camera and Tracy's cameras. So for people who are into the history of this thing, and we're going to try to do more and more of that on the website to really put it out there, as much information as I can get so people can enjoy the history and the specialness of this as we go forward. It's really a pretty amazing project, and we're going to try to get as much information as we can out there.
So let's talk about the offerings that you have at 2024 Studios in Tribeca in New York City, what you guys are doing, what people can have done, what they can rent, how they can actually experience this original Polaroid technology with original film, with the original emulsion, with the original stuff, with the original guy.
The original guy. Almost as old as the camera himself. No, wait, I'm actually older than the camera itself. We offer our traditional rental package, which is a daily rental with full bronze color lighting and assistance in the studio. We have a beautiful 2,000 square foot space that we just got in Tribeca with a full kitchen and bathroom and things. So that's a step up for us. We never had the greatest studios in the past, so we're pretty excited about that. And so we sell the film a la carte per sheet. And then for the first time this year, we've recently started offering a portrait package, because what we would find is we get a lot of calls of people who didn't want to rent the camera for the day. They weren't professional photographers, or they weren't an ad agency or whatever, but they just really wanted a nice portrait. And we'd kind of shied away from that in the past, and we're now embracing that, where we'll offer our services. Because we actually have done a lot of portraits between myself and my photographer, Jennifer Trausch, who's our director of photography now down in New York. She's a great portrait photographer, and so we've decided that we will offer a package to people where they can come in for a couple of hours and get nice and relaxed, and we can do hair and makeup if they like and everything, and really do just a really incredible single portrait, couple, family, whatever people want. And I think that's a nice break for people. Because the way we did it in the past was we would say, all right, we'll rent the studio, but you got to find your own photographer and do that. So now we're offering sort of an all-in-one service where we can take our skills and knowledge as portrait photographers and really give people this incredible thing to keep forever for their family or friends or whatever. My dad's long since passed away, 20 years, and I have some portraits of him on 20 by 24, and I can't tell you how special those things become as the years go by. I mean, they're so realistic and amazing, and I can just remember the moment that that picture was taken when I look at it. I mean, they're just so realistic, and they capture such an incredible moment in time that it's really a keepsake. So that's one deviation that we're offering now, and we hope that a lot of people will start to take advantage of that.
No, I think it's a very unique situation to be able to get your portrait taken with this type of equipment. Like you said, you have a 20 by 24 piece of art that you can't get anywhere.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's unique. It's just not some digital snapshot that somebody pumped out on an inkjet. It's real.
Right, exactly.
Do you seize that moment in time?
Completely. Yeah, I mean, it has a presence. And again, going back, I'm a big fan of digital, but you just don't have that same presence that I've seen. It's real. It's hard to describe if you haven't seen it, but there is a sense of reality that seems to transcend photographic process.
It is unique. I mean, I have to say, it's very, very cool. We actually have a really cool film that we have that we're going to be putting up here on Inside Analog Photo TV. Of course, you're going to put it on your website. That goes through the whole process of the whole camera, how it works, and I think people are going to find it really interesting.
Yeah, no, we've been excited about seeing that for a while up on our site and looking forward to it quite a bit. Also, for the listeners, not only do we have the presence of our website, but those of you who are on Facebook, we do have a Facebook fan page. It's called 20 by 24 Studio. And unlike the web page, it's something I get to on a much more frequent basis, and I'll be posting different artists' work and things. So for anyone out there who's into Facebook and does stuff, it's a great immediate way to see what's happening in the world of 20 by 24.
Well, no, definitely. I mean, it's something you need to follow, and I think they can contact you or Jennifer to talk about studio rentals. And like you said, if you rent the studio for the day rate, and I'm sure if it's more than one day, with anything, the more you buy, the better the deal is.
Exactly.
And you can actually learn this process, and you can actually do a project on this camera.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, we obviously have a lot of experience. We've done a lot of great projects with a lot of great people over the years, and we'd like to offer that to everybody who wants to come in.
And what have you found that if someone wants to do a project on the 20 by 24, I mean, do they need to do thousands of exposures? Have you seen people that have done 20, 40, 50? I mean, how does that typically work with your ex-clients and the clients you have now when it comes to doing a project on this type of equipment and this size of a camera? I mean, some people will shoot stuff for years doing a project. Some people will go and do a project in a weekend. I mean, it just depends, I guess, on what you're doing. But what have you seen with doing this on the 20 by 24? It's such a large format. It's not a high-speed deal. It takes a while to shoot each one of these things to set stuff up. So how's that usually work?
It really depends on the situation. I would say that we had reached a level of proficiency in the late 80s and early 90s where we could run the thing as fast as people wanted. You know, the film obviously was less expensive then, and it seemed like there was no limit to it, which at a point in time that was true. So we could do 90 to 100 exposures in a day. More likely now is probably 30 to 40 would be the high end. It's more expensive now, obviously, than it was 20 years ago. Now it's rarer. So we also are conserving the resource a little bit, and so I think we're a little bit more careful. The clients are a little bit more careful, so it's a little bit more considered. So what once may have been the crazy day of 100 pictures is now maybe going to be 40. And more likely is a number of between 10 and 20 on a given day. So you take your time a little bit more. Unfortunately, there aren't any smaller Polaroid formats to test with anymore. We used to have that. People could shoot an 8x10 or a 4x5, but that stuff's rarer than our 20x24 now. You could do pack film, perhaps, but it's not going to match. It might be Fuji or something. So we just try to use our expertise and experience to just get you where you need to be as fast as possible based on what we know how to do. We will always work with the client to give them what they want.
Well, when you shot mine, you racked that thing out to, I don't know, 40 inches of bellow extension. That must have been, what, ISO 1?
Well, yours went all the way. I mean, 160 inches. That dropped that film, which is 100 ISO film, to about 12.
And you guys nailed it on the first lick. Bang.
We did.
So it just goes to show you that you guys know what you're doing, and people can come in when they want to do things, either with a model or some still life. Now, you have other lenses that if people want to do closer up things. I mean, you had that camera stretched out 60 inches with their bellow to do a headshot that was bigger than life size.
Yeah, the lens we used for you was a 600 millimeter or 24 inch. We actually think of our lenses in focal lengths of inches just because of the scale of it. 600 is kind of the normal lens by default. But we also have, say, a 360, which will allow us to do 2-3x magnifications. We're very lucky that our lens set, they're old Fujinon lenses. We have a 360, a 600, and a 1200 millimeter lens, all of which have the same size thread. And what we discovered by total happenstance many years ago was that we can swap the rear elements of, say, a 360 on a 600 and get a 450 all of a sudden. And we haven't really played with the 1200 yet in terms of that. 1200 is interesting. We just got this lens back, and so that's a 48-inch lens. So 48 inches is infinity. So when you're racked out at 60 inches, you're only magnifying 30%, and you have to be like 25 feet away from the subject. So it's not really an indoor lens per se, but it's great because it really flattens out the image quite a bit. And so we're going to be experimenting with some swapping some elements of that to see if we can get a 900 out of it, which might be kind of cool. So, yeah, we have a whole array of lenses and different magnifications and possibilities for people.
So, John, let's give everybody a call to action. Where do they go look at the website? What's your phone number? How can they talk to you? How can they see this stuff? What if they got a bunch of money and they want to buy a camera from Tracy? I mean, how does this stuff work? How do we get a hold of you and check this stuff out?
Okay, well, probably the number one resource would be the website of the studio, which is www.20x24studio.com. And on that, you'll actually have a contact for Tracy Storer through Mammoth Camera. You'll see there's actually photos of his camera on there, and there's a direct link to him. There's also a direct link to for rentals and everything. If people just want to call direct without bothering to go to the website, that would be 212-925-1403. And I also want to remind everybody who's into Facebook to just check us out. Our fan page is 20 by 24 Studio on Facebook. We'd love to get comments and opinions of everybody on the studio there. But there's a lot of great information on not just 20 by 24, but a lot of Polaroid artists and developments with the collection. So people who want to be up to date on all that can check it all out there.
Definitely so. And you can also go over to Inside Analog Photo, and there'll be a link up there we're going to put up. I think this is the truly greatest photographic process that's left anywhere in the world. I mean, it's so rare that it's rarer than anything else.
It is amazing, and I feel pretty privileged to be able to keep it alive and keep it available for people.
It is great stuff. John, I really appreciate you spending all this time to talk to us today, explaining what's been going on. We definitely want to talk to you again about this instant transfer photography that you've been using with this Fuji stock and what you've been teaching. Your photography is beautiful, and this is just a really cool project. And it's just so cool to see you guys keeping this historic process alive. This is great work.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be on your show, as always, Scott.
Well, there you go. John Reuter and the 20x24 Polaroid and, of course, 20x24 Studios in Tribeca. Great work going on with these guys. Unbelievable. They have the last stash of Polaroid film ever anywhere. Anywhere. This is it. There's some pack film left. You can buy some things on eBay. Of course, Fuji makes beautiful pack film. They have the Instax cameras. It's great. But you know something? The original Polacolor film. This is it, brother. There's no more. These guys have 500 cases of 20x24. And you, anybody, can rent the camera that comes with the studio and help. You can make this unbelievable work. You can go have your portrait taken. If you just want to go down and have your portrait shot on this unbelievable ultra-large format, this one-of-a-kind, unbelievable stuff, you definitely got to check out what John and his guys are doing over there. Of course, him and Jennifer are running the studio. They have this film. They have spooling machines. This is just an incredible story. And, of course, you can look to Inside Analog Photo for a complete video overview of this camera and how this works. This is just one of the last great photographic processes left known to mankind. The Inside Analog Photography radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com. Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, over at www.apug.org. Our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.